Howdy, howdy, it's the old professor here. You know, after hearing our Woman Crush Wednesday on Elizabeth McGee a while ago, so many of you buzzkillers wrote in to say you wanted to know more about the early history of the board game Monopoly, and we contacted Mary Plum, the author of The Monopolist, the book that gives us the history of the game and the lawsuits that surrounded it in the 20th century. She very kindly agreed to come on the show, and so, thanks to the wonders of the interwebs, we were able to talk to her about it all. So, now let's cross over to that interview. Yes, as promised, we're here with Mary Pallon, who's going to talk to us about Monopoly and about the extreme complexity of the early history of the game. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, fine. Thanks for coming on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and about how you came and hit upon the idea of Monopoly and the origins of Monopoly, and write, so much so that you wrote an entire book on it?
Sure. And, you know, thanks so much for having me. This story was a huge accident. I've always loved games and puzzles and history. And in 2009, I was on staff at the Wall Street Journal and writing about, you know, the big story then, which was the financial crisis. And I was going to mention in a story just in passing, blah, 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 Monopoly was invented during the Great Depression. And the Journal, you know, is a paper that has to be bulletproof. You have to, you know, make sure you know where you got your information, and it's a very strictly fact-checked place. And I was looking around and it wasn't adding up, and I, you know, I kept finding different stuff. And I know this may surprise you, but sometimes you can Google things and not find what you're looking for.
I know that very well.
Which is exactly what I was going through. And I, you know, tried calling people, looking at things. And then on a whim, I reached out to Ralph Ansbach and said, you know, hey, I know this sounds crazy. I saw that you were involved with, you know, in some litigation with Parker Brothers back in the 70s, or, you know, maybe even early 80s. I'm just trying to find out what the deal is with Monopoly. And he immediately got back to me and said, oh, I'm so glad you asked. You know, for 40 years, I've been talking about this and not enough people listen. And he started telling me the story of Lizzie McGee and the origins of the game, as well as his own legal battle. And it started out as originally just one article. And by the time that was done and it ran in the Journal, I had more questions. Right. I wanted to know more about who right. this woman was, and more detail about what exactly had happened.
Yes,
to
what
it.
We should tell Buzzkill is that Ralph Ansbach was the inventor of the game Anti-Monopoly and had a long-running legal battle with Parker Brothers. But we'll get back to him later on in the show. Yes, our listeners will know that we did a Woman Crush Wednesday on Elizabeth McGee a little while ago and the invention of Monopoly, so they already know a little bit about it, but those shows are very, very short. So could you tell us a little bit more about how she invented it and how it sort of kind of spread in her world?
Right. And she's a fascinating person, right? I mean, she's, you know, kind of born into this other time. And I think that there's a lot of Lizzie McGee's of history.
Oh, yeah.
There are
yeah.
a lot of people who invent, who are politically active, who create, and for a bunch of reasons will get kind of written out of the narrative. So she creates this game, the patent she applies for it in 1903. It's granted in 1904. Interestingly, on her patent application, she uses her initials.
Yes, that's right.
Which, you know, very few women were permitted or really encouraged to patent things then. And if you did, that would be the way to do it. And so her game takes off among like a who's who of left-wing America. So, and that's not surprising given her political interests and history. So it's played a lot in universities. There are versions of the game in Boston. It was played at Columbia. It was played a lot at Quaker colleges, you know, it was played at Haverford. There's some indications it went, you know, further west in Indiana. And when people were playing these games, they would localize the board. So her patent, you know, has like these very specific properties and things, but then the folk origins of the game, so we're talking about 1904 to like the mid 1930s or so, people would customize things. And that's what one of the things that was so fun about both the research for this book, but also, you know, looking at what Ralph found in his lawsuit, is that, you know, so many of us think of the very, you know, specific Monopoly properties, but that's not actually how it was, that people made the game their own and tinkered with it. One of the big groups of people who played it were, there's this community called Arden, Delaware, which I didn't know much about before working on this book, but it was a single tax community, and single tax philosophy is kind of, unless you're an economist, probably something most people don't know about, but it was this big political theory that Henry George had promoted. And Henry George, you know, was a name that, again, wasn't one that I was familiar with. But one of the things I thought was so fascinating about him is that he was a huge deal in his life and time. And he wrote this book called Progress and Poverty that was a massive bestseller. And I would read these newspaper accounts of him doing these lectures and how charismatic he was and how riveting people thought his ideas were. So not only was Lizzie McGee kind of forgotten, but I think one of the rewards of doing historical work is you like rediscover these people and you kind of, you know, not to get too intense, but it makes you think about your mortality. You're like, wow, Henry George was this huge deal a century ago. And now I don't think most people on the street could name him. So the game traveled like that. Yes, we need to
remind everybody that then her game, The Landlord, was named originally The Landlord's Game.
Exactly. Yes. She renews her patent in 1924, which is kind of concurrent with the patent laws at the time. And one of the mysteries of the story is just how much she knew about how the game had spread. I mean, this is obviously pre-internet. You couldn't punch in, you know, the name of your game on, you know, Kickstarter and see how much money you've raised or anything like that. But a version of the game is played by Quakers in Atlantic City. And they made a couple of modifications to it. And it's a version of that game that is ultimately sold to Parker Brothers.
Now, do we know why the game was particularly attractive to Quakers, or was it just picked up by people who were Quakers and they spread it amongst their community?
That's a great question. I think it was both. I mean, Atlantic City in particular was a complete melting pot at the time. And the Quakers in Atlantic City have this really fascinating history too, because so when you look at Atlantic City and its heyday, there were different hotels for kind of different purposes. The Atlantic City was also a very segregated place too. So you had black hotels, you had white hotels, and the Quakers often had their own boarding houses there because they didn't want the drinking and they didn't want the gambling, but they still wanted the fresh air and the beach.
Right.
So that was pretty common. And, you know, there's a lot of Quaker history in Pennsylvania. So I think that, you know, kind of like a lot of inventions, it kind of passed through in a community where there was a whole mix of people. The Quakers, though, do kind of add their own spin to it a little bit. There's research that indicates that the earlier versions of Monopoly have a lot more auction pieces. And if you've ever played Monopoly with the proper rules, you know there's a lot of negotiating. But the Quakers, you know, add some more fixed prices to the board because they don't like the loud kind of cacophonous auction aspect of it. And there are accounts that came up in Ralph's trial where there's a really interesting history of dice games and kind of how, I mean, we think of board games today as being so milquetoast, right? And so like, you know, right? Like they're really sweet and earnest. But for the Quakers in a lot of communities, even in the, you know, 20s and 30s, games with dice were seen as sinful or taboo. And so some of the Quakers who were playing it then, particularly there were a group of Quaker teachers, were both trying to use it to teach children, but also very conflicted because if their parents or grandparents came over, they would like hide the game or downplay how much they had played it. So it was so funny to me to think of Monopoly as like a scandalous thing.
Because they see them rolling dice, and rolling dice might have gambling and all sorts of other connotations and things.
Exactly.
Even though Monopoly, it's harmless, and in other games, it's harmless too.
Exactly.
So does everything spread sort of word of mouth? I know Lizzie McGee she self-published it, if you will. But is there any attempt to say, you know, hey, this should be a bigger deal than just some of us making our own games?
Yes. Obviously people were making their own games, but a gentleman named Rudy Copeland had tried to sell a version of the game and market it. There was another gentleman, Dan Lehman, who had played it, you know, in college, and he tried to sell a game called Finance. So other people had tried to sell this game before. And then when Parker Brothers, so Charles Todd, who's a gentleman in the Philadelphia area, he learns a version of the game and teaches Darrow, who's a friend. He knows him socially.
This is Charles Darrow.
Charles Darrow, people think
invented the
game. Yes. And when Darrow sells his version of Monopoly to Parker Brothers, one of the things they later do to kind of try and protect their claim is they actually acquire Lehman's game, Copeland's game, some of these other things to kind of try and cover their bases, so to speak. So not only were people trying to sell this game, Parker Brothers was very aware of this in the 30s.
Yeah. So I talked about Lizzie McGee's homemade, well, spread of her game, but also the homemade boards on our Women Crush Wednesday. And I said, you know, these were done on oilcloth and boards and all kinds of things. So what might have been impossible for Todd and Daryl to try to trace, you know, where did Boardwalk come from? Where did Go to Jail come from? Did it all come to the Landlord's Game? You know, there are all these games out, the versions of the games floating out there.
And one of the mysteries that Ralph's case helped me solve was exactly that question. Uh-huh. I thought, so there's a 1935 patent that Parker Brothers, received. And I thought, well, how could they have gotten that patent approved when, and you know, patents are public record, they're very easy to find, when there was not only one from 1904, but a renewal in 1924. And when Ralph went to kind of answer this question on his own, for his anti-monopoly case, and he went to the patent office, there's a thing called a patent wrapper, which is like all the information that goes around a patent to give you context and understanding of why it, you know, came to be. And he goes to find the patent wrapper for Monopoly and can't find it. It's just gone. It's just missing.
Right.
So, you know, when Parker Brothers would say, we have a legal claim to this because we have this patent in 1935, one of the things that Ralph brought and kind of pushed them on was like, well, wait, should this patent have been granted in the first place? And the circumstances seem a little murky. So who knew what when is really tricky. And the kind of one of the smoking guns in Ralph's case on that point was he gets his hand on these letters between Robert Barton, who was then the CEO of Parker Brothers, and Charles Darrow saying, you know, hey, I've got some questions about the game's origins. Could you write up a history? And, you know, Darrow waffles
right,
on that.
Right.
So there's a lot of there's some ambiguity, but also some clarity. And like, I think the clarity for me was like Parker Brothers realized they had a problem on their hands.
Well, let's talk about Daryl and Parker Brothers more fully after this sponsorship break that we're going to take now. Before we went for a sponsorship break, you were saying how Parker Brothers and Charles Darrow had this problem because, after all, there are these thousands, well, not maybe thousands, but certainly lots of versions of the game out there. And Charles Darrow was telling this story about how he had seen one and invented the game from there. And Parker Brothers was learning how to deal with it. So how did how was the standard Monopoly origin story sort of crafted and put together by them?
Sure. So when one of the things that happens with Monopoly that I think is really important to keep in mind as we're looking back on it is that I don't think people really realized that this was going to become a game that we would be sitting here talking about, you know, 80 plus years later. No commercially sold board game had really exploded the way that Monopoly did during the Great Depression. And keep in mind that, you know, Parker Brothers was on the brink of destruction, like a lot of companies during the Great Depression. Darrow himself was, but nobody, I mean, a game hit is rare enough. A perennial, like something like Monopoly, just hadn't happened before. And one of the things that happens with Monopoly that's unique is that even today, board game designers are very seldom acknowledged on these games,
right?
Like when you buy a book, you know who the author is. When you go to a movie, you know who the star is, maybe even the director as well. But with board games, there's a very different culture around that. And Darrow becomes promoted as the quote-unquote inventor of Monopoly. And Charles Darrow becomes this kind of rags-to-riches story. The story is that, you know, he is in his basement, his family is starving, and instead of going on the government dole, he, you know, creates this game, and it creates, you know, fame and fortune for him and Parker Brothers, and off into the sunset they go. And it's an amazing story, even if it's not exactly true.
Yeah.
And that becomes part of the game's promotion and what people still really cling to. And, you know, the version of Monopoly that I had as a kid had a version of this story tucked into it. And that's actually what I believed until, you know, 2009. Why would I have any reason not to?
Right.
You know, it's just a beautiful story. And I think that's what I and a lot of other people really cling to.
Do we have any reason to believe that Charles Darrow, I mean, after all, some of the version of the story is that, well, some of what he says in his story is true. He did see the game somewhere in a friend's house, and he did sort of develop it. Do we know whether or not the rest of, you know, whether he was making it up about he was the sole inventor or he had heard of Elizabeth McGee or anything like that? He could have just said, you know, I knew nothing about the Landlord's Game before. All I saw was this, and on and on and on.
Right. And it's, I think to be fair, there's no way that Darrow necessarily should be expected to know the entire history of the game before 1904.
Right.
But what Charles Todd, the friend who teaches him to play, and later in Charles Todd's deposition as part of Ralph Ansbach's anti-monopoly case points out, is that Darrow knew he did not invent the game. He learned it from a friend, right? Okay. So even if he didn't know exactly where it came from, he knew he didn't gin it up in his basement and whittle away at these wood pieces. And, you know, like that by virtue of the Todd, and Charles Todd's wife, Olive Todd, also gives a deposition. And so there's many people who, you know, have gone on the record saying this game not only was around before, but like this guy didn't know what it was. Yeah. Like we taught him how to play it. And where it gets murkier there is that the game starts to be sold commercially. Darrow is being propped up as the inventor. And then Elizabeth McGee, who at this point is, you know, an older lady living in Washington, D.C. in pretty much obscurity. Yeah. She had worked as a secretary in the government. She'd worked in the Postal Service. She lashes out and she calls two reporters, one from the Washington Post and one from the Washington Evening Star. And she holds up a version of her game and says, hey, this Monopoly craze, this started with me. It didn't start with this guy.
We have a picture of that on our website of Elizabeth McGee holding up both games.
Exactly. So I find it hard to believe that Darrow wouldn't have known about that backlash that, you know, not long after his game explodes, this woman comes forward and says, hey, you know, sorry, buddy, that's not the way it happened.
Well, you're talking about the game exploding and all these things. It has fantastic growth at the sort of later, the Parker Brothers version in his later years, once it gets, you know, on a massive distribution. How does that happen? And after all, it's the Depression. People are not spending money frivolously, yet here's this board game.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, when I started reporting this in 2008 or 9, there were a lot of little trend stories about board games having a renaissance because they're cheaper than going out to the movies.
Right, you stay in.
You can use them over and over again. They're cheaper than video games. So it seems like there's kind of this counter-recession trend towards board games. And again, like one of the things that's so unusual about Monopoly is that it's kind of ubiquitous in households, right? So the idea that you can buy one set and you're pretty much good to
go for
a long time. So from a budget standpoint, it's it makes a lot of sense. I think there's also something really fascinating psychologically going on with board games. I think that one of the reasons I love games and defend them is that I think that they kind of give you this venue to you know, role play. I mean, I guess Dungeons and Dragons and stuff takes that to another level, but an arena to act out things that you maybe can't in real life. So for example, in my family, I'm the youngest child, so I can't beat people at football. It's not, you know, my brother was so much bigger and taller than I was. It wasn't going to happen. I certainly wasn't going to outwit the adults in anything. But with Monopoly, you kind of start out with this idea of like, okay, the four of us are going to go head to head and I might even have a shot.
Yeah, right.
I might even win. So there's this thing too with Monopoly being about, I mean, what was so counterintuitive about it being successful is that, you know, a game about money and banking and real estate sounds so dry.
It does.
And yet there's something about, and I love watching, you know, my nephew, when I play with him, like kids love counting out that cash and they love the like owning a property, like they get to kind of play grown up in a way. And at a time when people, you know, couldn't throw around a lot of cash or even buy property or stuff, I think there is like a fantasy element to that time in particular being really ripe for people to want to do a game about banking and real estate where they were in fact in charge when, you know, in this country in the mid 1930s, that was so far from what was happening.
Right. And like a lot of things, people talk about the movies going up in sales and things like that in the 30s. It was, you know, almost a necessary diversion. And this is a perfect one of those. Well, let's take a station ID break. And when we come back, we'll talk about how controversies over Monopoly continued into the 70s and 80s.
This is General George Washington. I never go into battle or start a new country without consulting Professor Buzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back with Mary Pallon, who's helping us try to understand and untangle the fantastic growth of monopoly and the fantastic complexity that's in monopoly from the teens to the 20s to the 30s. And it even goes into the 70s. You know, one would think that once Parker Brothers had essentially laid out their story of how the game was invented, that that would be it for the rest of time. But what happens later in, well, in my lifetime anyway?
Yes, the 1970s are, you know, the story takes this kind of epic turn. You know, Monopoly is also unusual in that it's one of the few games that you learn often, it's passed down generationally, which right. is part of why a lot of people play it wrong. So sometimes you don't necessarily learn Monopoly, you learn the version that your parents think is Monopoly, or aunts and uncles or grandparents.
And people continue to make up stuff and add to the rule and change things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, ironic because it takes it back to its folk origins if you think about it. So it's a version of Monopoly that this gentleman, Ralph Anspach, is playing. He's an economist. He lives in Berkeley with his wife and his two sons. And one of his sons, you know, precocious, smart kid, says, well, Dad, if monopolies are so bad in real life and the OPEC oil cartels are in the news, and, you know, this is the stuff that Ralph is also exploring as an economist and talking to his students in the Bay Area about, well, then why, what's the game of Monopoly all about? Because not only am I trying to clobber everybody else, I'm trying to get control of everything. And that's actually not how the world works.
Like, no, yeah.
So, yeah. So Ralph Anspach, you know, thinks that he's totally right and that he needs to set out to make a more philosophically pleasing version of the game. So he creates this game called Anti-Monopoly. And, you know, if Monopoly is all about getting total control, Anti-Monopoly is about breaking things apart. And it's a very, there's some fun twists about the game. So, you know, lawyers can serve indictments. It's much more modeled after kind of the Naders, Raiders, heroes of, you know, the early 70s in California. So he makes this game and he starts selling it. And, you know, what could be more appetizing in the early 70s than this kind of like countercultural game. And it isn't long before he receives a notice from a lawyer working on behalf of Parker Brothers that says, hey, you can't make this game anti-monopoly. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a claim to monopoly. And Ralph Anspach isn't the type of guy to take things, you know, sitting down. So he says, what do you mean? You can't have a monopoly on monopoly.
Yeah,
it's
right.
a free market. Yeah. It's competitive. And that kicks off this legal battle that goes on for a decade. It ends up at the steps of the Supreme Court, in which Ralph becomes kind of consumed with this question of like, can I make my games? And if so, legally, what does that mean in terms of copyright, trademark, all these other things? But also in that process, unearths the story of Lizzie McGee and what happened at Parker Brothers in the 30s. And a lot of his fate in court hinges on proving the true origins of the game.
So because, of course, the lawyers on both sides go back and try to find out the actual history and find out what happened. So they're digging through what are effectively public records, and they find Lizzie McGee's patent and on and on and on.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that blows me away about the story, and I came to it, like I said, in 2009, you know, Ralph was coming to it in the 70s, is that how much paperwork there was.
Yeah.
I think as a reporter, or if you're a lawyer, right, you're building a case, you're building a narrative, you're building a story. And, you know, Lizzie McGee was this, you know, the first part of the book, I set out to more or less try and write her biography because nobody had done it yet. Yeah. And I was terrified because I thought, gosh, you know, I've sold this book idea based on a woman who's known for being obscure, right? She died in 1948.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
She didn't have any children. She had outlived her husband. And to find, you know, newspaper clippings about her and her writings and these pieces and be able to put together that mosaic is amazing, because I think that, you know, I'm also doing a lot of family history research right now, and it's really tough. You know, there's a lot, and there's so many pockets of history where we just don't know. We don't know anything. And to have enough that Ralph could not only win his case, but that I could write a book about this woman, you know, I didn't know if this was going to work out, to be honest. And it took a long time because you're, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack.
Exactly,
but
exactly,
it's amazing to me that her story survived at all.
So this Ralph Anspach case then jumped right out at you, because you're writing a book and you needed and you wanted some sort of drama, some sort of interesting conflict, and there it is.
Well, and also I don't think you can tell the story of Monopoly without telling Ralph's story, because it's so clear that he found, you know, this evidence. Like, he was the one who kind of stumbled into it.
Yeah.
you know, almost by accident. And I don't think we'd be sitting here talking about this if it weren't for not only his case, but his tenacity and putting this all together. And I love stories. You know, one of the things I think is so wonderful about history is just how, even when you're looking back on it, how unpredictable it can be and how serendipitous it can be. And that there, you can have these people who never met, you know, Lizzie McGee died in 1948. Ralph was looking at this decades ago, and they still are connected.
Yeah, that's right.
That you can kind of have your dead friends. And, and, you know, then here I am, you know, another generation later looking at it. And now I'm connected to Lizzie McGee in this weird way because I'm trying to be like a pseudo biographer by way of Ralph, who was looking at this in the 70s. And so it's funny to me how you can have these people kind of linked together through documents, records, photographs, in this case, games, and these early players. And one of the coolest things about the book that I didn't predict that I was thrilled with is that after it came out and I would go on book tour, descendants from the original Quaker families and people who had played would show up at these book events and say, oh, I'm so-and-so's grandson or great-grandson, or there was this thing in her attic. And I always wondered, you know, why did we have this monopoly? And so the idea that like part of this history is still very much living.
Yeah.
And that, you know, one of the groups of people that really connected with the book that, again, I couldn't have predicted were women in tech. So, oh my gosh, it's so good to know that there's like, there were these women game designers, you know, a century ago, and you know, there still aren't enough of them today. But that was like a really cool reward that you're kind of raising the dead and bringing them back to life in a weird way. And you don't know how it's going to go, but to have people now connected to the story in these kind of interesting ways, some of whom were board game nuts and some, you know, couldn't care less.
Do we know if any of the old handmade games still exist? Some of these people came up to you and said, oh, you know, in my great grandmother's attic or whatever, I found this thing. And do they have anything donated to museums, or are they just, are they out there?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I started this, the Forbes Gallery in New York had a beautiful collection of early Monopoly games. And then when Forbes was going south, they had an auction. And we know where some of those games ended up. So, for example, the Strong Museum in upstate New York has one of them. And, you know, it's on display and you can go look at it. And they've been really fabulous curators of that board, as along with other toy archives. But some are in private hands. We don't know. And I have photographs of a lot of this, or did or had access to, because of the court case. But when Ralph was doing his case, he was quite literally traveling around the country with a camera taking photographs of these things. And thank God he did, because it's so fractured and they're all over the place. So yes, a lot of the games do survive and they're kind of all over the place. And I've heard from private collectors through the years who have this or that or the other. There's still some games in Arden, Delaware. They have a fabulous museum that kind of talks about the history of their community. And some of this is mentioned there, but it's really all over the place. Phil Orbanes has a pretty incredible game collection. You know, he was at Parker Brothers for a long time. Right. So they're definitely, you know, Board Game Geek is a really great website that kind of, it's almost like the Wikipedia of board games. So, you know, with the internet has also come people scanning these things. Tom Forsyth is a collector in Portland who has an early Landlord's game and has been really wonderful in terms of kind of sharing his information and building a community around asking these questions. Like, this is the one I found in my family's attic. What do you have in your family's attic? And so that that's still around, but it's not, there aren't nearly as many that we know of as I would like, but you know, these are also really, really old games. And I think the other thing with games is, you know, comic books, people used to like stuff their leaky pipes with pages of, you know, like original Supermans and stuff. The idea that board games were high art is really, really new. I don't think a lot of people realized how valuable these things could be, how beautiful, particularly some of the early Monopoly games were. So that's also a cultural shift that I think, unfortunately, has meant a lot of games haven't survived.
Yeah. And you can buy the anti-Monopoly game right now. It's on us. We put the website on our blog about it. But it looks very much like, at a distance anyway, a lot like Monopoly, but it does have all these other aspects to it. So buzzkillers out there can get part of this history that we're talking about. It's still going on.
It's still going on, yes. And all it took was a 10-year-long legal battle.
That's right. Almost bankrupted him, Misa. And so, well, thank you very, very much for being on the show. And do you mind telling us what you're working on now? Because after all, we want to get a jump on the topic and interview you before your next book comes out.
Sure. So it is currently out. It's called The Kevin Show. It just came out in March. It's about this Olympic sailor who has a rare form of manic depression called, or bipolar disorder, whatever you want to, your preferred term, called Truman Show Delusion.
Yes.
So I've spent the last 3 or 4 years reporting out his delusions to try and figure out what really happened, what didn't, and kind of how our brains work or don't work. Mm-hmm. And so I write mostly about business and sports. So obviously Monopoly kind of falls more in the business, bucket. And this is much more of a sports book, but it's not a sports book. It's about, I was joking. It's a beautiful mind with boats like that. It's, you know, it's kind of a different type of sports story that I hadn't seen out there. So, yes, you can purchase it online and I'm very excited about it.
Well, thanks so much again. And, we'll say to the Buzzkillers that we'll talk to you next week.
Excellent. Thanks so much for having me.